Hello and welcome to Reading McCarthy. Reading McCarthy is a podcast devoted to the consideration and discussion of the works of one of our greatest American writers, Cormac McCarthy. Each episode will call upon different well-known Cormacian readers, scholars, other experts to help us explore different works and various essential aspects of McCarthy's writing. My name is Scott Yarbrough, and I will be your host for these forays into the deep wilds, dark groves, back alleys, and badlands of Cormac McCarthy. This episode is the second part of my discussion with Peter Joseph. Our guest today has been often mentioned on the podcast, and I have typically referred to him as a Renaissance man of the arts. Author, actor, artist, auteur, and more, Peter Joseph's books include The Wrong Reader's Guide to Cormac McCarthy, All the Pretty Horses, Adventures in Reading Cormac McCarthy, Cormac McCarthy's House, Reading McCarthy Without Walls, Liberty Street, Encounters at Ground Zero, The Way of the Trumpet, What One Man Said to Another, Talks with Richard Selzer, and The Wounded River, which was a New York Times notable book of 1993. His films include the award-winning Liberty Street, Alive at Ground Zero, Shakespeare in New York, Hell, Bard Talk, A Few Things Basquiat Did in School, and Acting McCarthy, The Making of Billy Bob Thornton's All the Pretty Horses. As a painter, his McCarthy-related exhibitions have been shown throughout the world, including, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, Peter, but just go with it, Luleå, Sweden, Coventry, England, Sydney, Australia, and here in the States in Debraya, Kentucky, and in El Paso, and in Santa Barbara. As an actor, he has played, among many other roles, the character of White in The Sunset Limited at the Westerner Theater at Center College. He's a frequent keynote speaker for the Cormac McCarthy Society, and he currently lectures on film for the Frick Estate Lectures at Nassau County Museum of Art on Long Island. Would I be wrong in thinking your Liberty Street Alive at Ground Zero film is probably the one that's had the biggest audience of your various films you've done? And I guess the one, of course, we're all fascinated about is Acting McCarthy, The Making of Billy Bob Thornton's All the Pretty Horses. And of course, what we're really all interested about is there a mythical Thornton cut of the film out there, or is it really just a Hollywood story? Or what was it like making that one and meeting those people and talking to them?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a great question. The reason that the film is not available, or you can't find it on Amazon as a DVD or even on YouTube, is that after the film was completed, after we interviewed Billy Bob and Matt Damon and Henry Thomas, you know, Ted Talley, who wrote the screenplay, Julio Matroso plays the captain, Miriam Colon plays the aunt, even Fred Murphy, who was the second unit director and cinematographer, and who also filmed The Gardener's Son. So after all of that, and I spent really just 9 months to a year doing the edit, we discovered that the cost per minute for the clips from the film would have made it so expensive that I probably could have made four more films for that cost. And we didn't have it anyway. It's not that by Hollywood standards, it was unreasonable. It was just that we didn't have it. I mean, at the time, but I say we because my pal Raymond Todd and I was involved in every aspect other than the editing. He was with me for all the interviews. We traveled all around the country. We went down to see Lucas Black at home. The average cost for a documentary, I remember hearing this at that time, minimal, was around $200,000. Wow. And we made this entire film for about $15,000. And the reason we did that is because we did everything ourselves. You know, we shot it ourselves. I did all of the editing, all of the audio mix down, all of the color correction, and, you know, all of the conducting of the interviews. So we just couldn't afford it. And so basically what we said to the producers, which was Miramax and Columbia, well, at least would you let us give copies of the finished film to the people who are in it? Mm. And they said, no, you know, the legal department said, no, you can't even show it to them. So we got one of Billy Bob's producers to get a hold of somebody at Columbia, and they gave us permission to show it in a few nonprofit venues, and also, thankfully, to give copies to Matt Damon and Billy Bob and so forth and everybody who was in it. And that's the condition in which it remained as a, really not even a DVD, it was a VHS, until finally I decided first of all, we needed to make a DVD out of this thing. And perhaps what I needed to do was to re-edit in such a way that you would not be including the clips if the price was still beyond our range. The problem is that Miramax was Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
And Miramax basically doesn't exist anymore. And so to find out who owns that catalog, it's someone in foreign lands who bought up the whole catalog, probably doesn't even know what the hell is in it, but just, you know, laid down the money. It could be oil money. We don't know. And we've tried to contact this gentleman to see, you know, what it would cost us to get the rights to include those clips, and we still haven't heard back. So what I might do is to generate a cut of the film that leaves out all of the clips from all the pretty horses. When you have a two-hour film, you really need to show some bits of the film.
Yeah.
And there is such a thing as, you know, fair use.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very complicated, you know, issue.
Yeah, it's so vague, fair use. And I think people should be more aggressive in asserting it, because when you read the law, it's really pretty straightforward, and it's almost just by universal sufferance that people have all said, okay, we'll assume they can sue us for this, or when they assert that they want to charge for it. I wish that we just had a few crackerjack pro bono attorneys who were willing to fight this fight all the way to Congress and see what happens. Just choose someone, you know, someone or some worthy project such as this and fight the fight, because this is not, it's not the case like when they republished half of Ulysses in the United States because it was banned, and they, as criticism, took about 50% to 65% of the words and republished it in these critical works. And that wasn't really done to hurt Joyce. It was really done just to get the book legally into the States for people. It's very rarely the case that any of these would stop someone from going and seeing the original work or spending their money on it. And I'm sure that there, you have to have a stopgap to stop piracy. But beyond that, it's ridiculous how we have to follow this.
Well, it is interesting that academic publishers now are being totally unmerciful with authors who are quoting Faulkner or Hemingway or, you know, whoever they're working on. You've got to get permission. I've had authors call me and say, Peter, what the hell do I do? They want me to go. And I spoke to so-and-so's agent, and the agent wants to charge me per sentence, and I've got quotes all over my book, and what do I do? And it really is up, it should be up to some of these academic presses to be saying, we'll look into it for you, we'll check it out. Right. There's a tremendous amount of presses having their legal departments and their legal departments writing contracts. I mean, you could do an entire podcast about this, podcast that basically asks the author who's not receiving a dime to find out who's going to do the blurbs, suggest a marketing strategy, provide cover copy.
Yeah.
In addition to text, everyone at the press is on the payroll, including the person who, you know, sweeps up at the end of the night. The author's being paid nothing. Sign away your rights in perpetuity for media that are not yet known to man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and, you know, there have been times when I've looked at contracts and I've had to say to the publisher, excuse me, but there's not a page in here that mentions that the author will be paid anything. Oh, well, we generally don't pay our authors. Well, you don't, because most of them are full professors.
Yeah.
This is what I do for a living. I write. There has to be a page that says something. And then they try to make you feel guilty about asking to be compensated.
Well, they're making money on your book.
Yeah, well, surgeon author Richard Selzer that I mentioned earlier, he taught me a lot, because I would hear him on the phone speaking to some college or a medical school or nurses association that wanted him to come and visit, and they'd say, but we really don't have much of a budget, or but you'll love it and we'll show you our new Kennedy wing of the library and so forth. And he would say, this is what I do for a living. This is what I do for a living. And if you've ever been on these jaunts, you know, he used to call himself a strange migratory bird that roosts on podia throughout the country. He was no longer practicing medicine. He got a pittance for publishing these books, and he was helping to pay the bills by giving these readings. And even about that, they really didn't want to compensate him. There's an author named Jason Mazzone, who was in the paperback version of my book, Liberty Street, Encounters at Ground Zero. And he's an expert in constitutional law. He used to be at Brooklyn Law School. Now he's at Chicago. And he wrote a book called Copyright Fraud. And the book is not about violations of copyright. That's not the prime focus of the book. The book is about something that he discovered when he was reading documents about the Constitution and versions of the Constitution and commentaries on the Constitution. He noticed that materials that are in the public domain were being copyrighted, and that technically speaking, he didn't have the right to quote from these materials that are in, you know, the Library of Congress or the 42nd Wow. Street Library. And he said, this is crazy, and it's just gotten so out of hand that I kind of wanted to write a guidebook. So I said to him, well, I noticed at the beginning of your book, it's not copyrighted in your name, and it's not copyrighted in the name of the academic press. It's copyrighted in the name of a board of directors of some institution. He said, yeah, wow. Yeah, I know. He said, here I am writing a book about writers being taken advantage of, but I was just so eager to get the damn book out that I just signed whatever they gave me and handed it in. But to go back to your question, what was it like? We had the idea of making three documentaries, each one about the making of a film based on something by Cormac McCarthy. We thought that Tommy Lee Jones would be making Blood Meridian, but that got red-lighted. I think it was after the Columbine massacre that the studio decided that a film of that level of violence would not be appropriate. At least that's the story that I heard. Yeah. We did interview pretty much everyone involved in the Gardner stunt, and we did interview everyone that we could get hold of involved in all the Pretty Horses. And I have to tell you, Scott, it was an extraordinary experience, because the stereotype of the airheaded actor, I've never found that to be the case. I've never had an occasion of interviewing an actor or an actress where they haven't been just so smart and so compelling and so committed to the material. Brad Dourif,
right.
Ned Beatty, Bruce Dern. Bruce Dern knew that book by heart. He knew everyone else's part. He adored that novel. He adored the screenplay. He loved working with Billy Bob. Matt Damon, Henry Thomas. Henry Thomas has read all of McCarthy. He was honored to meet him. He and Matt went riding horses. Just, you know, actually, Henry Thomas is the only actual Texan who was in the film.
Yeah.
And he took Matt, you know, riding for weeks in order to prepare to make that film. And he said, yo, you know, that book was our Bible. And it was when Billy Bob met McCarthy, he said, you know, I'm sorry I fucked up your book, but, you know, I did the best that I could with it. And Billy even added to the screenplay. And as it was, the screenplay was beyond respectful to Cormac McCarthy. Properly filmed, that screenplay would at least have had to last for 2.5 hours. And when Ted Talley met with Mike Nichols, who owned the rights, he said, you know, I'd love to do this, but you've got to give me a long film. And Mike Nichols said, absolutely. When I spoke to Billy Bob at the Sunset Marquee Motel in Los Angeles, at that time, it had been cut down from something like 3 hours and 47 maybe to 3 hours and 7 minutes. I may be getting the length not quite exact. And I'll never forget, he said to me, if you take out one more sentence, it won't make any sense. Mm. All right. So he's talking about roughly 3 hours and 7 minutes. And this is while the film was still being edited, so that all of these actors and actresses who loved the material and believed in it, including his cinematographer, Barry Markowitz, who shot Sling Blade and shot The Apostle, they didn't know what would be included and what would be cut. There was pressure from Harvey Weinstein,
right,
largely based on the fact that they were calculating how long could the film be and still have the maximum number of screenings at a Cineplex. But you're not going to get the maximum number of screenings if it's 3 hours and 7 minutes long. The film was actually finally released at under 2 hours. It's something like 1 hour and 57 minutes. And so many of the scenes that were described to me, Billy Bob, Henry Thomas, Matt Damon, talking about the way that the film ends and this long sequence of Matt riding out slowly, and by accident there was an airplane in the final take. Then Billy Bob realized, of course, I don't have to cut that out. That's perfect, because that's part of what the theme is, that this kid's got nowhere to go, that he's been oiled out of existence, of being a ranch hand and so forth. All of that, the only way that I was able to see those sequences was by listening to them describe it to me as the way that it was shot. I never saw the longer version of it. I tried very hard to, I even flew out to Los Angeles with the expectation that I'd be able to go to one of the screenings, and it just didn't happen. So it's a sad story. From what I heard over the years, even Daniel Lenoir, who was a buddy of Billy Bob, was replaced as the composer. And when he left, they gave him his music. They basically said, well, you know, you can take your music with you. When I say they left, the producers, the studios just didn't want his contribution. Marty Stewart was brought in. I think he's also a friend of Billy Bob. I don't know this for sure. It's a decent score, but it's a very different kind of score.
It's like a Magnificent Seven update more than
the
plaintive kind of quiet quality of that novel.
Well, and I remember hearing that Billy Bob had said that unless he could use Lenoir's music, he would never do a director's cut. That's what I heard. I had also heard that when someone came onto the set to begin participating in the film, that Billy would drive around and play them the Lenoir music and say, in effect, if you want to know the mood for this film, listen to this music. Mm. And so that director's cut, to this day, has really never happened. And a lot of years went by before Billy Bob directed another film. I remember him saying to me, from now on, any contract I sign, it's just going to be three words, kiss my ass. Yeah. Because he trusted that they said, hey, Billy, you know, you're the one to do this. He really, he had been used to directing his own work. Right. He said, I don't do this. Someone else is, it's a great novel. And they said, no, you can do, you know, we trust you. You're the one. You should make it. You're the right guy for this. And that's not really what happened. As a matter of fact, I remember a commercial for All the Pretty Horses, in which the background music was U2.
Wow.
U2, they were playing rock and roll for the background. Wow. That's how far they were reaching to make this somehow some kind of a contemporary cowboy romance.
I guess Matt Damon's career was taken off and Penelope Cruz was this international star, and they were just going to determine to ride that horse, so to say. Very bad pun, but I couldn't stop myself. As far as it could go, it's such a shame because you can see the bones of a good movie in there. And I really don't have any problem with, obviously the casting's a little older than the characters in the book, and they made that decision. Otherwise, I feel like I don't have any particular issue with any of the casting in the film at all. Matt Damon, surprisingly to me, does pretty well as John Grady. It just doesn't tie together. Is it the completed product on the screen or on the television screen from your DVD player?
Wouldn't you love to see the longer cut?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would.
That old house, once I never found. That old house out at the edge of town. Now you can't blame it on me. Now I remember we drove out to see it. Burning you, burning me. There was a girl, I don't know what for. There was a girl up on the second floor, standing in the Martin Road. No one to tell me to call or to go. And her mama used to work in the 5 and 10 cent store. Smoke is everywhere. Smoke is in her hair. She's the one we'll have to tell you why. Like the secrets you have found, burning me to the ground. She's the one we'll have to tell you why. Out on the bridge, it's not such a long look down. She likes it here when Gay Street is too much town. She's got the moon in her best dress on. The boys all watch it until she's gone. In the morning you can find her asleep in the lost and found. Begging for a second life from me. I hear it at night, it sounds like the Tennessee. There's another house on fire. Deputy Sheriff wants to make me a liar. Was it two McCarthy girls or was it three? Smoke is everywhere. Smoke is in her hair. She's the one we'll have to tell you why. Like the secret she has found. Never gonna leave old Knoxville town. She's the one we'll have to tell you why. She's the one we'll have to tell you why. Tell you why. Tell you why.
So I probably should move on to a big question here, Peter. And when I had Jay Watson on the podcast, we talked about Faulkner and McCarthy. That was before your moratorium on no more Faulkner discussions. And I told him, or it may have been a different episode with someone else, but I've told the story before about the Suttree 25th anniversary conference, where someone asked a panel of Faulknerians, who's more important, McCarthy or Faulkner? And when they came down with Faulkner, I could see the hurt in your eyes. And my feeling has always been that I know the book that is your favorite. And I think you've given it away in your books as well. But I will ask you this, what I ask all the guests on the podcast, what is your favorite McCarthy novel and why?
I'm really impressed that you remembered that episode at that conference, because it was driving me nuts that even Noah Polk, who gave the keynote, I felt something about the way that he's talking about McCarthy that I don't think he's even read all of McCarthy. I think he's still fundamentally a Faulknerian, and there are all these Faulknerians running around, and there was so much Faulkner, and I kind of sort of knew the answer. I think exactly the way I phrased it was something like, is there a novel that you would consider to be the best of McCarthy that you would hold up against what you consider to be the best of Faulkner? And not a single one, not a single one on the panel said yes. Yeah, I was disappointed, but I more or less expected that. Well, you're right. I don't know how you figured it out, but it is Suttree. It is Suttree. I love All the Pretty Horses, and I love Child of God. I don't think of The Orchard Keeper as sort of new, raw, budding, beginning McCarthy. I think it's a masterpiece. I think Out of the Dark also. I think parts of The Crossing, even No Country, which is not a favorite of mine, I think is absolutely brilliant. But yeah, Sutri, that's the one. It always has been. That's the one that Rick imposed upon me directly after he told me to read Blood Meridian. That came next, really. And I really related to that in a way that I've related to few books. I have so many reasons why it's a favorite that you probably, maybe if you do a panel on Sutri, you could invite me back to talk about some of them. But just to give you a couple, maybe a few things that perhaps you haven't heard yet in some of the previous podcasts. For one thing, it's a great novel about a great city.
Yeah.
I'm a street eater. I'm a cities person. I love few things better than to be walking the streets of a great city or even just an interesting smaller city. I love filming. I love photographing. I love writing. I love absorbing it into who I am and what I do. And I think that Sutri does for Knoxville what Ulysses does for Dublin. It's what Tropic of Cancer does for Paris, and what really, as I was saying, A Movable Feast, which I think of as a novel, does for Paris. There aren't that many great New York novels. Interestingly, Tropic of Capricorn, another Henry Miller, kind of does that for New York. But, you know, the title of the book is Sutri, and you get so much of Knoxville in it. And I think that everything in the book has to be Sutri because that's what it's called. It doesn't say the guy in the book is the title. Only applies to him. It's everything. And I think absolutely every detail in Sutri applies to who he is and what he does and where he's going. And I think critics are dead wrong who say that McCarthy doesn't give you the internal life of his characters. I think he gives it to you in every sentence of every one of the novels. And boy, is it true of Sutri. Everywhere that he goes, everything that he describes, that's him. And Sutri is also Harrogate. Sutri is also the Ragman. Sutri is also Ab Jones. Wesley Morgan, who you mentioned, and who gave me that wonderful walk around for my second collection, and also is a fellow New Yorker. Wesley is born in Albany, actually. Ah. Yeah. So another Northeaster who is enamored of McCarthy's South and the Southwest. He has a wonderful website called Searching for Sutri, in which he's tracked down so many of the names and places that are in the novel. In many cases, characters who were still alive when Paula Faria and I went down there with Wesley. We met Jay Bone. Paula shot pool with him. We met Walt Clancy, who is still alive and, walking the streets of Knoxville. We met Big Frig, John Hannafin. He didn't change their names. He didn't do what Kerouac did, which is that he changed everyone's name to protect himself legally. So there's a lot of the city in the novel, and I really appreciate that about it. But even more so, to get back to what you were saying originally about the virtuosity of the language, and Cormac's brother Dennis, who you've spoken to about his novel, The Gospel According to Billy the Kid, Dennis agrees with me that it really is one of, if not the greatest poem in the language by an American. It really is. Every sentence of that novel is exquisite work of poetry. And I would hold it up against Leaves of Grass, the first edition, Walden, For Whom the Bell Tolls, As I Lay Dying, the work of Wallace Stevens, Emily Dickinson. It's really just an absolute masterpiece of poetry in prose. And I love that about it. Another thing that I love about it is what I think of as its overarching theme. It's something I can relate to my own life. I always think that what Sutri is saying to us is that above, beneath, beyond our day-to-day routines, our daily life, there are forces that if we don't get in touch with them, if we don't connect with them, then we are not ever truly, authentically alive. But if we do get in touch with them, they could kill us.
Wow.
And I think you have both aspects of that equation on pretty much every page of Sutri. And I think that's part of what gives it its extraordinary power. I just see that everywhere in the novel, in addition to its I guess you could say almost Dickensian prodigality of character. There's a lot of Dickens to me in McCarthy, and especially in Sutri. There's also a lot of Henry Miller in Sutri. When I met McCarthy with Paulo Faria, and we had breakfast, of course we weren't talking about his work. We knew that. But I did mention Tropic of Cancer because I just had a sense that he had read and had admired Henry Miller. I later found out from reading McCarthy's correspondence with Woolmer, the book dealer, that he said, in effect, to Woolmer, the only Miller that I don't have is his correspondence that was called the Hamlet correspondence with a guy named Michael Frankel. And so he kind of did a trade with Woolmer in order to get a copy of this rare edition of Miller. And I said something about Tropic of Cancer, you know, being one of the great works of the century. And he agreed with me. And, you know, I said it still holds up. And he said, yeah, it holds up. I think there's a lot of Tropic of Cancer in Sutri. It's one of the most liberal, capital L, small L, novels that I've ever read. I would rank it with Ulysses in that regard. It's just so open-hearted. It's so inclusive, you know? Yeah.
And that probably doesn't get the respect it's due when you think about the fact of when it's set and where it's set and how Sutri moves, you know, just fluidly between these different groups and class systems and racial enclaves, and none of the other people around him can move back and forth like he can. Red Callahan's group are not necessarily making friends with Ab Jones and those guys. They might be accepted, but they're not friendly with them. And Harrogate, of course, is too much an unformed cretin in all of the glory to really do it in a way, although he's interesting in the way that all that's shown. And there's just something I think that's probably very under discussed is his kind of, I don't know, cultural polymorphically change himself to fit all these different circumstances and to fit in with all these different groups. And I think that should really be talked about a lot more with the book as well. You're absolutely right.
Well, I remember researching it, trying to get at what Knoxville was really like in 1949, 1950, and all of these documents of what was restricted, you know, and what was for whites only. And I mean, and also, yeah, also reading accounts by writers and journalists who had been there that basically described it as one of the most racist places in the United States. And yet here you have Sutri hanging out with the, you know, as Paul Simon says in the Boxer, the poorer quarters where the ragged people go. And, yeah, you know, what is one of the last things that he does before he skips town is that he shakes hands with Trippin' Through the Dew.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, African-American transvestite. How more open-hearted? It really is sacred-hearted in a way, you know, to get back to what I was saying about going straight to God by bypassing religion. There's a Tibetan proverb: where there is veneration, even a dog's tooth emits light. And you just see that all over Sutri. In one of your conversations, I think it was with Diane Luce, you mentioned something about Sutri being downtrodden. And I know what you meant by it, but really, he's having a ball, you know? He's what I call killing himself to stay alive. He's, you know, when he's out on that boat, he's on his own. When he's in town, he's ready to get the shit beat out of him. That's part of what he needs, just to stay afloat, and, you know, to move through whatever he has to move through. I see it as one of the most high-spirited, one of the most, well, whenever anyone would talk about McCarthy as a nihilist at any of the early conferences, I would always raise my hand and say, well, what about Sutri?
Yeah.
I mean, and think of the ending. It's one of the great, great endings of anything that's ever been written. Fly Them. He's talking to Sut. He's talking to himself. He's talking to you. And he's talking to me. You know, Fly Them. Whatever's going to kill you, whatever's holding you down, whatever you know is wrong, you can get out. You can just step out. I think that's why so many of his characters, they're half dead. You know, John Grady is half dead. Sutri has just had a floor waxer cracked over his skull. And what do? They just get out, you know? They unhitch themselves and they leave.
Light out for the territories.
They do.
Aunt Sally, she's going to adopt me and civilize me, and I can't stand it. I've been there before.
Yeah.
I think we're in accord. I think it's just a...
Is it your favorite, Scott?
I think probably it is. I always have, like everyone else who's come on the show, when they say there's, I think intellectually, I have this incredible appreciation for Blood Meridian because it's such a staggering work of genius. And as is Sutri, but I think Blood Meridian's tighter and it's less discursive. It's more formed, if you will. It's a little less episodic. But in terms of the book that both can tug at me the way that The Road and All the Pretty Horses can, and can tease out my intellect like The Crossing and Blood Meridian do, and it just has it all going for it. And I think it's astounding. And I'm always amazed when I meet people who love most of his works and don't love the novel. And sometimes they just don't like the character, which I get, though I disagree with it. I like the character, even though I think he manages to be his own worst enemy and to shoot himself in the foot continuously. But that is so many people I have known and have been at times in my life. It just makes him that much more real to me. I think it's just amazing. I gave a passionate, we had to do there was an American novel class and when I was working on my PhD, and we all had to choose the novel that should have been included and wasn't, and give a 15-minute presentation on it. This is the one I chose and gave it. And this is 1992. I think All the Pretty Horses had just come out. And so I gave an impassioned speech about it to the class, and a number of people went out and bought the book, and a number of them complained to me that they had bought the book and, you know, didn't like it the way I did. But I think it's amazing.
Well, you know, you mentioned the difference in tightness of form between Sutri and Blood Meridian, but Sutri is a classic example of how there's something about McCarthy that I always think of him as a housebreaker. He's a second story man in that, yeah, regardless of how many times you've read the novel and of how well you know it, and how much of an event it was that you first read it. It's kind of like, it reminds me of when you first see a Kubrick film. When you remember the film, remember Dr. Strangelove, you don't remember it from the last time that you read it. You remember it from the first time you read it because it was such an event in your life. It was such an indelible experience. But in spite of all of that, somehow McCarthy has the ability to break into your home, to take it off the shelf, and to insert sequences and episodes, not that you don't remember, that you are absolutely convinced were never there. Because each time that you read it, you say, the hell is this? I never saw this before. How he does that. I know that's a form of magic. Okay. That's trickster McCarthy coming in and adding these sequences.
And that's truer for me in Sutri than it is in Blood Meridian. Sutri to me is the one that's eternally rewarding of the reread more than any of them. And it's the one that I think I told Diane this when she came on to talk about Sutri. And I do, by the way, hope and plan to have a round table, because I think we've only just started digging into the uppermost layer of it. And to have you and hopefully Diane and maybe one third person on as a round table that we can have a discussion about it again.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. I think over and over again, though, we can dig into this book and find out more and more as well. Well, Peter, we haven't really talked about the music, but I hope you'll indulge me in letting me use parts of your McCarthy Variation songs, Wesley's Song and Sutri's Song, in this podcast when I edit it all together.
Oh, sure. I love a little bit of airplay. It's so much fun doing that. When I was playing White in the Sunset Limited, I wrote blues for Mr. White. I haven't recorded that yet, but it's from Black's point of view. It's a blues.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember singing it backstage before I went on to do the show. That's just an enjoyable. Well, Wesley Morgan, actually, I remember Wesley calling me the McCarthy homestead, which you have described in The Road. That's where the father takes the son, and that's where the family lived for so many years off Martin Mill Pike, which is just on the outskirts of Knoxville. It had burned down, and Wesley called me actually from the ruins. And at one point he said, you know, maybe you could adapt an old song to commemorate the fire. And I said, well, no, I'll do you one better. I'll write you something that somehow incorporates that into it. And I called it Wesley's Song. And I always kind of regretted that I couldn't get more of Sutri into it. So I just took the same melody and I made a Sutri song. And it's very enjoyable to do that. It's pretty far afield from the world of academic criticism, but it is one way of reading the novel is to sing a song about
it. We'll let our listeners decide this, but I meant to bring that up, and I'm glad you did, because you pick up on an aspect of Sutri's character and his relationship with his friends that I think anyone who's hung around with a group of reprobates understands, and it's the pugnaciousness of them. When outsiders or the law or whomever come after them, there's going to be violence and there's going to be trouble. And at some level, it's about holding on to dignity, holding on to independence, not allowing your fate to be dictated by others. But it's right there in the song. So we'll let people listen to it.
She might not let you down. I've been told deserve me a better life. Whores and bawds won't do ye without a wife. Well, marry up a few for me. If I'm going to jail, I'll do it free. I'm not paying out double every time I want to roll the dice. Bought me a bridge, bought me a couple of more. Didn't cost me nothing like the Miller department store. Same as with my friends, you wouldn't give a quarter for a shipload of them. A touch of hair on my head be another decoration of war. Might be trouble at night, might be a hell of a fight. I won't go looking, but it just might track me down. I can't stand standing still. Maybe if I go and get my fill, them good old boys will have the courtesy to kick me around. What I know, tain't like what I don't. What I will taint like what I want. Forget your 9 to 5. I'll be killing myself just to keep me alive. Waiting on the Lord to call me on the telephone. I would never care if you sons of bitches don't want me at heaven's door. Might be trouble tonight, might be a hell of a fight. Well, I'm a virtue man, so I'll let you name your vice. I can't stand standing still. Excuse me while I get my fill. Just like dying, you don't get living twice. Just like dying, you don't get living twice.
We'll definitely say that. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on. I've wanted to have you on since early on, and so it's nice to have you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great, and thanks so much for doing this whole series. We really appreciate it. I know it's a lot of hard work.
It is, but it has been my pleasure. And so thanks again to our guest, the multi-talented, tirelessly energetic Peter Joseph. His books include The Wrong Reader's Guide to Cormac McCarthy, All the Pretty Horses, Adventures in Reading Cormac McCarthy, Cormac McCarthy's House, Reading McCarthy Without Walls, Liberty Street, Encounters at Ground Zero, The Way of the Trumpet, What One Man Said to Another, Talks with Richard Seltzer, and The Wounded River, a New York Times notable book, 1993. Films include award-winning Liberty Street, Alive at Ground Zero, Shakespeare in New York, Hell, Bard Talk, A Few Things Basquiat Did in School, and Acting McCarthy, The Making of Billy Bob Thornton's All the Pretty Horses. His painting exhibitions have been shown in Luleå's Sweden, Coventry, England, Sydney, Australia, and Brea, Kentucky, El Paso, Texas, Santa Barbara. And as an actor, he has played, among other roles, the character of White in The Sunset Limited at Weisinger Theater, Center College in Kentucky. He has spoken often for the Cormac McCarthy Society, and he currently lectures on film for the Frick Estate Lectures at the Nassau County Museum of Art on Long Island. The songs included here from his McCarthy variations, including Sutri's song and Wesley's songs, and they're excerpted throughout this episode. And thanks again to our normal house band, as occupied by the role of Thomas Fry, who composed, performed, produced the theme music and interludes we use in Reading McCarthy. The views of the host and his guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their home institutions or the Cormac McCarthy Society, although in our hearts, we hope they'll follow along. Download, follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're agreeable, it'll help us if you provide favorable reviews on these platforms. If you enjoy this podcast, you may also enjoy Great American Novel Podcast, hosted by myself and Kirk Kernut. To contact us, please reach out to readingmccarthy@gmail.com. Social animals, despite the darkening land and the world to come, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook.